First, you don't have to pay the broker fee. I do feel like the brokers earn that fee and they deserve it. But if you get it off market, you don't have to pay that, which is nice. The other reason is, and so we negotiated seller financing. We proposed it. I think we did, I want to say 20% down, something like that. I mean, the sell on mobile home parks, why you want to buy them is that they are sticky. And so, you know, multifamily, people can move relatively easy.
Gabe Peterson, welcome to Real Estate Development Land to Legacy. We have another fun conversation today. Today, our focus is going to be mostly on mobile homes, RVs, self-storage facilities, what it takes to acquire and run one, how does our guest Gabe deal with financing them, what's seller financing, how he generates leads and finds properties, and then also we're going to talk about how he's raising capital for his acquisitions. Gabe, welcome to the show.
Yeah, Eugene, thanks for having me on. I'm excited to jump into this. It's very rare that I get to talk to somebody here in Tacoma or in Washington State, same
in
time.
Washington. You know, every time I don't look at my notes way ahead of time very often, but this morning I looked at it and I'm like, Tacoma, we should have done it in person. It's the second or third time I'm having somebody from, you know, local, and I'm like, we need to do that in person.
For sure.
So that's my cue to look into it sooner so that we could plan for it. But at any rate, happy to have you on the show. So tell me a little bit about your business and why did you choose to invest in properties that you invest in?
Yeah. So yeah, we own mobile home parks, RV parks, self-storage facilities. And I mean, I don't want to go too far into the story, but the gist is I was working corporate, you know, up at Microsoft doing the thing, didn't like it, landed into real estate. Can't remember how I actually got into that. I think it was my aunt who originally sold me a house and we flipped it, made money. And I was like, this works. So right. I was flipping and I was doing wholesales until about 2020. And I realized like it was going to take me ages to get where I wanted to get to with these single family rentals. So I started looking at, you know, what to buy. Obviously, multifamily, that's the first thing everybody looks at. And that's what I was going for. But I met somebody and who had gone, I think he had taken Kevin Bupp's course, I think, on mobile home park investing. He told me about, you know, the spiel, the sell, like why is mobile home parks a great investment? And I was like, that sounds great. So we started calling for mobile home parks, bought the first one. I think it was at the tail end of 2019 is when we got it under contract, and then we closed in 2020. These dates might be wrong, but we closed around 2020. Right. That was the first park, and then it went well, started buying more, and then I got shiny object syndrome and looked into self-storage facilities. I bought five of those, and here we are today.
Awesome. So let's pick a deal, maybe one of your early deals and maybe your first deal when you acquired it. Can you walk us through the underwriting, what you saw, how you financed it, what went wrong? What was your experience like?
Yeah. So the first one it was a mobile home / RV park here in Washington State. It was a smaller park. So it was, I think at the time it was 27 sites. And we've added sites on since then, but I think when we bought it, it was 27. And it was, you know, the backstory for the seller was kind of interesting. He was a huge potato farmer here in Washington. And he basically bought this entire town. It's George, Washington. A lot of people know it because that's where the gorge is. They do a lot of, amphitheater music kind of stuff. So in that town, and this owner, this potato farmer, he essentially bought the town. He owned all the land and he wanted to turn it into a theme park, a George Washington theme city, kind of like Leavenworth is, where it's kind of like a Bavarian. He wanted to do a colonial kind of theme, whatever. He didn't end up actually doing that. You know, I'm sure he was like, screw this, potato farming's better. And so he sold us this park. It was part of his portfolio. We never actually met the guy. It sounded like he was just one little asset in his vast, vast empire. And so we negotiated seller financing. We proposed it. I think we did, I want to say 20% down, something like that. At the time, interest rates were really low. So he gave us a really good interest rate. It was like 4 something. And since then, we refinanced. But when we bought it again, this was the first mobile home park that either of us had bought. So we were learning everything new. Mobile home parks, I mean, the sell on mobile home parks, why you want to buy them is that they are sticky. So, you know, multifamily, people can move relatively easily. They got their stuff, they move out of the unit and they're gone. At mobile home parks, they actually own the unit, they own the house. And so it's a little bit more difficult to move it. And so generally people stay there longer. And so they're stickier. You don't own the actual structure. So you only own the utilities underground, like the water, sewer, et cetera, electrical. And so there's no like broken toilets that you got to deal with, that kind of stuff. So it was a good sell. And when we did the underwriting, everything was, you know, we checked, this was city water, city sewer. And so there were some, you know, line breaks in the water, some just basic stuff that was remedied over time. But yeah, it turned out to be a good deal. I forgot what your original question was. I feel like I've been rambling, but.
No.
It turned out to be a really good deal.
How did you actually underwrite it? So you came across, was it listed with a broker or how did you even find the deal?
No, this was cold calling. So we got a list. We were calling owners. I can't remember how we got the original list. I think we you can go out there and buy a basic list of mobile home parks out there. And then you just start adding them, go to Google Maps, find the park, get the address, skip trace it, find the owner, call them. So that's how we found it. And like I said, we negotiated the seller financing. Underwriting. Okay, so that was your question. So when you underwrite the parks, there is the capitalized income and then non-capitalized, which is tenant-owned income. Somebody, if you own the mobile home there, you only capitalize the pad rent. If the pad rent is $300, that's what you're capitalizing. If it is, but if you own the house and then you rent it for $1,200, everything above that is sold on a gross rent multiplier. I forgot about that. When we bought this park, there were three or four homes that we actually got in the sale, but we didn't want to own them. So we immediately sold them to the tenants for a really, really low amount. It was like $500 or something like that. And they weren't in great condition and we just didn't want to do the flip and we didn't want to have to deal with maintaining a structure. That's the reason we bought mobile home parks is we didn't want to, you know, we weren't in it for the homes.
Yeah.
So we sold those immediately. And yeah, I mean, underwriting, it's just like anything else. It's just your net income. There's a lot fewer, the OPEX is a lot fewer because you're not really, the expenses are utilities that you're dealing with, property management, and then your basic, you know, insurance, taxes, that kind of stuff. You're not dealing with a lot of maintenance. There is groundskeeping that you got to do. But outside of that, there's not a ton of maintenance and repairs that you're doing to the park continually.
Got it. So educate me a little bit, if you don't mind. I mostly deal with multifamily, single family, so I know everything about building a structure. But with a mobile home park, well, first of all, terminology. There's mobile home park, there's manufactured home park, there's RV park. What is the difference? Or are they all synonymous?
Mobile home and manufactured home, that deals with the date of the manufacturing. So after, I can't remember what the actual date is, but before it was considered a mobile home, afterwards it's considered a manufactured home. I don't know why they made that distinction, but that is, they're the same thing. Mobile home park, manufactured home park, the exact same thing. I mean, in terms of what you're actually building, you're putting a pad there, bringing utilities in, it's the same thing. RV, obviously that's different. RVs are on wheels, you can move them around. They're not fixed to the ground. And actually that is what we really like is RV parks, but that function like a mobile home park. So they are it's long-term stay, extended stay RV. And so people come there, they bring their RV and then they live on the property for an extended amount of time. They're great. They're easier to fill because to get a mobile home into a park is actually very expensive. You have to bring it in and that costs, you know, $5,000-$10,000 to move it from wherever you're moving it from. You have to do site prep. You have to connect all the utilities. You have to skirt the home, bring in a deck, all that stuff. But for RVs, you don't. You just, you know, put an ad up, somebody brings their RV in, connect to the utilities, they're done. So RV parks, extended stay RV parks, we really like. You get basically the same income as a mobile home park and with the same kind of style, the same structure, you know, long-term stay, they're staying there as their home, but it's not as hard to get, the infill isn't as difficult. With mobile homes, the strategy really is to bring in homes and then sell them. It is extremely difficult to get somebody to bring their own home into a mobile home park. If you're filling a park, you have to bring the home in and sell it on contract.
Okay. Is the business model, and again, I'm asking from the development standpoint, but it probably be applicable to acquiring existing. Is the business model typically to sell the home and to let the tenant own the structure, but then you operate the land? Or as a developer, could I potentially buy these manufactured homes and just rent out the entire thing?
You could, but then, I mean, people do that. They it's park-owned home versus tenant-owned home, okay. But that defeats the entire purpose of buying a mobile home park.
I see.
Like you don't want, or at least from my perspective, people do this. It's a great strategy. It's definitely what people do. But when you buy a mobile home park, you buy it for the pad rent, and then you don't have to do the maintenance on the home. And so if you're doing infill, you buy the mobile home, you bring it into the park, you set it up, and then you sell it. And so it's no longer your problem.
Gotcha. All right. So going back to your first or maybe early acquisitions, before you had experience, before you knew what to look for, did anything go wrong?
Yeah, things always go wrong. Every deal I've done, I can think of things that have gone wrong. But,
what's the most memorable, I guess, that would serve as a lesson to the listeners?
Two of them pop to mind. I'll do one from mobile home, one from self-storage. So the second mobile home / RV park that we bought was in Washington State. And the septic tank failed like almost instantly. And they've updated their code requirements in this county, in Grant County. And so the new type of septic tank that you have to install is like way more techy than it should be. And so it costs like $45,000 to fix that thing and get it fixed up. And we kind of went in there understanding that. So it wasn't necessarily a mistake. It's just like, when you're buying a mobile home and it's on septic, sure, you're not going to have that, the cost that you generally, your operating expenses of a sewer line, a city sewer that you would every month, but those things do fail. And so that needs to be underwritten into your model. You need to expect that you're going to have to fix a drain line. You're going to have to, or a drain field. You're going to have to fix a tank. You're going to have to replace them. And so it's those big capital events that you're going to have to underwrite for versus the small, city sewer every month kind of event that you underwrite. So the big lesson there is to underwrite for more CapEx on the start line. Second deal that I felt like was for self-storage specifically. So this one, it was a small self-storage facility in Arkansas, and I had bought it as a flip. So I bought it for dirt cheap. It was like, I think I paid $150,000 for it or something like that. It was in Hot Springs, Arkansas, which has really good growth numbers, or at the time it had good growth numbers. And I didn't know too much about the metro, but I knew that it had good growth numbers, and that was what I was most concerned with. And so I bought it. I did my repositioning. I painted it, got things looking nice. I fixed doors, all that kind of stuff. And then I went to sell it. I think we put, $40,000 into it, and we sold it for $360,000. But what was it? It was the Saturday before closing. So we were closing on a Tuesday. The Saturday before closing, a group of guys went in there and destroyed literally every single door. They took one of those angle grinders and cut through every single door, completely destroyed the facility. And it was just a nightmare. But the lesson that I learned in that, we did end up making money on that deal, but not nearly as much as what I had hoped. And I just didn't want to go through that entire process again, like going through doing the rehab, all that stuff. I'd just done it, and it was just no fun. So the lesson that I pulled from this is specifically for self-storage, you need to be wary of property crime in the area. And that's very specific to like if a certain metro, Seattle, Washington has this number of instances of property crime per 1,000, that doesn't really tell you the story. You need to know if you're buying on First and whatever and Pike. You need to know specifically how much property crime occurs there. And you get that by calling the police station, asking them how many calls do you get for this area? Like, well, tell me about this area. What do you think? Because self-storage facilities are very prone to property crime. People break in, they try to steal stuff. Obviously, it's literally a treasure trove of people's stuff for criminals to break into. And so if you're buying in a city, you need to understand the property crime. And I wouldn't buy a small facility if it was in a city, because they're not going to produce enough income to support the security that you'll need to make it worth your while.
So you would literally call the police station and ask them for their records they would share it with you?
Yeah, I mean, you can ask, you know, how many do you guys get a ton of calls for this area? Just they're going to know the city better than you. Property, right. You know, property managers, police station, call them and ask them about the city. You can tell them what you're doing. Hey, I'm thinking about buying this facility. Is this area prone to crime? Do you get a lot of break-ins? Do you get a lot of what kind of calls do you get from this area? And they'll be, you know, they'll tell you. They're not trying to hold things to their chest or anything like that.
Is there a number that beyond which you feel like it's a red flag and below which you could still, you know, take that chance?
No. So in terms of when you go to like Neighborhood Scout or anything, they paint too broad of a brush for areas. And so they're not specific enough. Like you'll look at an area and it'll be this huge section of the city and they'll say, you know, 100 instances of property crime per 1,000 people. But that doesn't tell the story of the place that you're buying. And right. And so I never, there's not a specific like 80 per capita or whatever that proper instances of property crime per capita that I won't buy above that. It's just, I'll call the police, I'll call the property manager and I'll ask them about, you know, that intersection. What happens there? Like, do you guys get a lot of property crime? They're not going to tell you a number, but they'll be like, yeah, we get called there all the time. You can call for calls for a specific property, but I don't feel like that'll give you a good enough picture. I really asked just about the area, like this right. this corner. What do you think?
So it's really just sort of almost a gut feel based on a conversation with law enforcement to see if they're like, oh my God, this area is just horrible. We get calls all the time. To you, it doesn't matter what the number is. If you get that feedback, it's a red flag. Versus yeah. if they say, no, that area is generally fine. Yes, overall here is pretty bad, but we don't see a huge difference on this intersection or that property compared to another part of town.
Yeah. And I mean, I will go on like Neighborhood Scout and stuff and look sure. at their what they have. I can't remember where, you know, they got like five categories and the top one is super red and then the bottom one's, you know, white or whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the actual numbers that go to those, but if it is super red, that's definitely, you know, yeah. definitely a red flag.
Yeah, yeah. No, it makes sense. Makes sense. When you get insurance, like, you know, your regular liability insurance, I'm sure insurance companies track crime levels and they would probably gauge what the premium levels are. Does that, is that an indicator for you typically?
I have never had an insurance company mention property crime.
Okay.
They're super concerned, especially in Texas. They're concerned about hail, and you have to get additional hail coverage.
Okay,
but they've never mentioned property crime. I don't know why they should. That's yeah. very relevant. Now, to their model.
We see it frequently with builder's risk insurance. Same thing. We were working on a project in Tacoma, actually, and when we were shopping for builder's risk insurance, number of companies declined to even a bit on it because they said, looking at the map, the property crimes in that area where we're in the Dome District was too high. And there's homelessness, there's crime. And then eventually, I think two or three companies submitted their bids, but all three of them required a very short list of security companies that we had to engage
yeah.
during construction. And that was the only way that they would give us a policy is yeah. if we hired that security to
and
protect the site.
Those security companies are expensive too. I had to hire one to clean up that site,
mm-hmm.
you know, to protect the people that were doing the work, and they're expensive. Right. It's not oh, yeah. like a cheap thing.
No, not at all. Well, and there's different levels of security too. In some cases, you can get away with just cameras. In other cases, you have to have patrols out there,
mm-hmm.
like 24/7 patrols. But all right, so that makes sense. That's very valuable, useful lesson, Gabe. Now, you mentioned that you bought a list and you were just cold calling people trying to find properties to buy. I wouldn't have thought of that. My first guess would have been to call a broker and see what's actually listed for sale. Why is calling owners directly a better approach than just going through a brokerage community?
I mean, a lot of times, I mean, there's a number of reasons. First, you don't have to pay the broker fee. I do feel like the brokers earn that fee and they deserve it. But if you get it off market, you don't have to pay that, which is nice. The other reason is a lot of time you'll catch these guys just at the right time, at the right moment. And they wouldn't have listed it otherwise, but you caught them when they're, you know, maybe they had a bad day and they're just like, screw this facility. And they decide to sell. So it's just the fact that you can get deals that otherwise wouldn't be brought to market. And then there's the negotiating. I like to negotiate directly with the seller. I like to, you know, come to an agreement together. And when there's a broker involved, it gets messy. And sometimes you don't get it. Just, I don't like doing negotiations. I don't like doing negotiations through somebody else. I like to talk directly with the seller. Then you could do like offer seller financing a lot easier. And yeah.
Interesting. How do you start that conversation? Normally, I'll explain the question. When I look at a listed property, there's typically a set of documents already available. There's a price where you're anchored at. You can typically see some sort of a income projection to help you understand what, you know, potential cap rate. Sometimes they disclose the cap rate that they're asking. You have starting point. When you call people, how do you approach to even get into a number?
How do I approach getting to an offer number?
To an offer number, yeah. When you call them, you're like, hey, I want to buy this property. Isn't the first question they ask, what are you offering?
What are you gonna get me?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. I mean, but that is just like any, you know, it's based off their numbers. And so you'll say, hey, Bob, are you still the owner of this property? Yes, I am. Awesome. Would you like to, you know, we're buying properties in the area and we saw yours. We'd love to give you an offer. Would you consider selling? They'll be like, yeah, we'll consider an offer. Then you're like, great. And then we just run through the questions that we'll have that will give us the information that we need to come up with the offer. You know, self-storage facility, how many units are there? What are the sizes? What are the rates? And then the one that we usually get the most pushback on, but that you need is your P&L for, you know, the last 2 years. So can you provide a P&L? A lot of times, especially with mom and pop properties, their P&L is like their personal tax return. It's like impossible to understand. But, you know, getting those numbers will give you a place to start from to come up with your offer. And it's usually just based on a cap rate. I'll come up. I personally want a 9 cap or above. And, you know, I know market rates are a lot lower than that right now, but that's where we're at.
Okay. So 9 cap or above is still reasonable. It's possible to find properties that would sell at those rates.
The last deal that we got in that area was like at the beginning of this year. So owners are still looking for lower cap rates, but you know, it really just depends on what you're willing to take and just keep looking if it doesn't fit the profile.
Right. Interesting. Can you share what is like the general range? I mean, I'm familiar with multifamily, but what is the general range of acceptable cap rates for mobile home parks or self-storage facilities?
That will run the gamut. It really depends on where it's located, how nice of a place it is, all that stuff.
Okay.
But
gotcha.
You know, great metro, 5 cap. If it's not as good, if it's more rural, yada, yada. Self-storage, it's usually like around a 7. And then, yeah, mobile home parks, and it really, mobile home RV. RV is higher. You can get like 10 caps for RV, like if it's an actual RV park and not a long-term stay. Mm-hmm. But it is entirely dependent on where it's located, how nice of a place it is, if it's really old, really old units, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, interesting. So for developers listening to the show, is it still reasonable to attempt to develop new mobile home parks or RV parks?
We tried. So one of our parks it's only sitting on like a third of the acreage of the total parcel. And this town that it's in needs no more units. It needs more housing. And we came up with this whole plan. We had designs. We went to the city council and we tried to get it approved, and they just like pushed super hard. They did not want it. Mobile home parks, a lot of municipalities just don't like them. They don't want them in their town. They don't want more units in their town. So it is very difficult to get that developed. At least from what I'm not a developer specifically, and so I don't know a ton about it, but from what I've heard and from my experience with that one expansion that we were trying to do, it is difficult to do mobile home parks. Really, yeah, municipalities don't want them in the town.
So it sounds like regulatory hurdle mostly rather than business financial hurdle.
Right. Self-storage is overbuilt across the United States. I would not recommend anybody. Well, I mean, I don't want to give anybody recommendations, but I would look specifically into your net rentable per capita in the area. It's just overbuilt everywhere because it's so cheap to build and so easy to build. You're literally just throwing up some metal frame, metal walls, call it good, put a door on it. You got yourself a facility. Because of that ease, it's just way overbuilt. And so I don't feel like that is a good development play unless you find a pocket. But yeah, that's personally not across the United States. It's pretty much, I don't know. Again, I don't want to give advice. Maybe you, if you're in a specific location and you know of an area that doesn't have enough self-storage, you can build it. RV is, it's, again, I've never developed one myself, but I've heard it's a lot easier to get accepted. And usually when you build them, they're not in a town, like they're not downtown, you're building them outside. And so you can have a little bit easier of a time getting those pushed through.
Gotcha. And RV parks, if I understood you, there's some that are more longer term stay versus some that are essentially campgrounds, right?
Yeah. 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 Long term stay versus just your traditional RV overnight stay RV. I like the long-term stay because the cash flow is more steady. You know, you got people living there. It's predictable. Mm-hmm. And with short-term stay, it's entirely seasonal and it's not as predictable. But that's why cap rates are higher for RV parks is that they're a little bit more of a risk.
Right. Do you have to provide utilities for each pad in an RV park?
Yes.
Or is it centralized and they need to drive around to hook up to, you know, offload their sewer and whatnot?
Yeah, there are RV parks out there that just provide water and electrical, and then they have like a dump station for the sewer. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the market wants connection, you know, full hookups. If you build a RV park that doesn't have full hookups, you're going to have a hard time getting people in there and using your park because that's what people expect and what they want. That's with the exception of tents. And so a lot of RV parks have tent sites, and those are just, you got usually just electrical and water.
Got it. Okay. So your first deal, you convinced the seller to give you seller financing. Is it your typical model? Do you always negotiate seller financing, or is that on a case by case?
No, we'll do seller. I'll push seller financing every single time. And yeah, we got the first deal, second deal. I've done 3 self-storage facilities on seller financing. In fact, all but one of the mobile home RV parks are, I just recently did a financed RV park where I went to a bank, or a mobile home park, sorry, went to a bank and got a loan. But everything else, you know, I'm really pushing seller financing, and it just allows you to be a lot more flexible. You can, if a seller is like really stuck at a specific purchase price, they're like, I want $1 million regardless. That is what that's what's in my head, and I'm not going to give you anything less. But you think the property is only worth 750, or I don't know, these are just random numbers, but you think the property is worth a little bit less than that in terms of a cap rate basis. You can offer seller financing. You can do, you know, principal only. You can do a low interest rate, 3% interest only for X number of years, and then a balloon payment. So you can hit their number a lot easier if you know, people get stuck on certain things in their mind. And a lot of times it's then number, it's the purchase price. And so they'll get stuck on $1 million. So you can hit that $1 million by negotiating with the terms, you know, interest only seller financing. We did this one self-storage facility where it was kind of a development play, and we got it by offering interest only seller financing for 5 years, for 5% interest only seller financing for 20 years. And so we have 20 year interest only seller financing, and that's how we got it done.
Interesting. So you, in most cases, you don't want to go to the bank.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And that really only works if they don't have debt on the property.
Right.
And no bank is going to allow you,
they won't assign it. They won't allow assigning the debt. You could do it without declaring it, but then you're running the risk of them triggering the due on transfer clause.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Makes sense. Interesting. And so the seller then becomes in first position, holds a deed of trust. You give them typically what, about 20% down payment, or is that also negotiable?
That's negotiable too. You can do whatever, you know, the first one we did 20. Man, I do not remember the numbers, but a couple of them were very low. What the most recent one we did, I think it was 10%. I try to go low down payment, as little as, because then you have more money to actually work on the deal. And that's what matters, is the money that you're putting into it, not the money that you're putting down. I mean, you know, it all depends. But yeah, so down payment, we want as low as possible. They want higher, we want lower. And that's why you can kind of pull on all the different levers until you get something that works.
Right. Okay. So do you still acquire lists, or, you know, fast forward several years since you started doing this business, how do you find new properties?
I mean, we still work lists. We've been building our own list, and so we're still trying to make sure that we have the most recent contact information for all the properties that we're interested in, and then just being top of mind, calling them. we also look on Google Maps. And so a lot of the gems are not located in, well, first of all, they're not in the systems like Crexie or whatever. They're not allocated as a self-storage facility or a mobile home park for whatever reason in the system. It's not, that doesn't pull through. And so you don't have a billion people calling them like, hey, I want to buy your mobile home park. And then secondly, they're not on Google. And so they're not listed on Google as a mobile home park. And those are the gems that you really want to find, because those are, they haven't been hounded by other investors, and they're probably more likely to, you know, work with you on a deal. And to find those, we just use Google Maps. So we pick a city and we, you know, look for storage facilities, mobile home parks, RV parks. And if it doesn't have a website or a presence or anything, then we skip trace the property, the address, and look for the owner.
Interesting. How many people do you have engaged in that?
It has gone up and down. At the peak, we probably had 5, and now just 1.
Okay, gotcha. Interesting, interesting. And I guess it seems like you continue acquiring, you continue growing. Do you sell, or do you just buy and hold indefinitely?
No, and that has been the hard decision that I struggle with, is when is the right time to sell. I actually just had somebody on my podcast who he's a doctor, and he's been investing since the 80s. And I asked him that same question, and I like his answer, because I don't have a good answer. But his answer was follow the banks. And when the banks start tightening lending on a specific, you know, asset, on, you know, mobile home parks, then sell immediately. And when they're, you know, more lenient in a specific type of building or structure, then that's when you start to buy it. I think that's really smart, because I do not have a good answer for when to sell. I've listed 2 facilities right now, because they just, you know, I'd done the value add. I bought them, and we'd done all the value add. We've stabilized them, and it's been so hard for me to like just list them, because they're like, I don't know, it's a weird emotional connection to properties that you put a lot of effort into. But eventually I was like, I could, you know, my return on capital was really low. And I can get a better return if I take that money and put it into something else. And so I finally was like, screw it, I'm selling it. And so I listed them. Yeah, we do sell. I am coming around to the position that it is, you should probably sell everything once you've stabilized it. Once you've, you know, maximized the value, you should sell it and roll it into a better asset, something that you can, that will give you a better return.
Let me rephrase the question. As I understand, you work with investors who participate with you. Mm-hmm. When you raise capital, what do you tell them? What is your hold period? Because they typically ask, well, when do we get our money back? How long? What is your time horizon?
Got it. Okay. If there's external capital, then right. I mean, 5 to 7 years is hold period. But most of the deals that I've done, I've been able to do with my own capital. So that's, you know, negotiating or my own capital or a partner's capital, or we didn't have to do a syndication. So we didn't have to go out there and get a whole bunch of people to raise debt and or raise capital and put the money into the deal. If you do it with your own money or somebody, you know, a partner's money, you and a partner's money, then you have the flexibility of when to sell. If you have other investors, then no. But yeah, if you're projecting for a return for investors, then 5 to 7 years.
Got it. Yeah, that makes sense. Awesome. Well, tell me a little bit about your podcast. You mentioned that you have your own podcast. What do you talk about? And is this something that generates investors for you, or what is your objective within, what is your goal?
Yeah, The Real Estate Investing Club is the podcast. Eugene's been on there. He was a phenomenal guest. So if you guys want to check that one out, you can check it. Yeah, it is The Real Estate Investing Club is the podcast. realestateinvestingclub.com is the URL. We are asset and agnostic. So we have, if you're an active investor, we like to do the interview. We've had guys on there who flip farms, you name it. We've talked to people. One of the most popular ones right now is people are doing rent by the room. A lot of guys are coming on doing those. But yeah, I mean, that's the podcast. It's a short one. We try to keep it around 20 minutes. I started it because COVID happened and I was doing a lot of in-person networking, couldn't do it anymore. So I started the podcast and I ended up loving it. Just sitting down, talking with people, you know, having 3 conversations every Friday. And it's just a lot of fun. And I always, it's a great way to raise capital. Like if you want to raise capital for deals, it's a phenomenal way to do that. It also positions you as a person of authority in the eyes of a seller. And so if you are reaching out to a seller and you're having a conversation, you email them in your handle, it shows your podcast. I've noticed that people tend to look at you a little bit differently. You know, it's just a nice benefit in the negotiation process for buying deals. And so anybody who has the inkling to start a podcast, I say definitely do it. An interview-based podcast for real estate is awesome. You get to learn from people like Eugene. I don't do development. Eugene does. He came on my podcast. I got to learn a ton about it. And then the kind of ancillary benefits are sellers are going to look at you with a little bit better lens, and then you get to raise capital from it.
Yeah, I totally agree. For me, it's been an awesome opportunity to meet people and frankly, to learn a lot more. I've been in multifamily, single family the last 20 years. I know literally nothing about mobile home parks or RV parks. Recently, I was talking to an owner who has a property. Part of it could be a good candidate for an RV park. And I'm like, I mean, I've seen RV parks in movies. Like, I don't even know where to look for. But now I learned something new. And when the next opportunity happens, I'm sure Gabe and I would love to, if nothing else, share ideas.
Yeah. Yep.
Absolutely. Gabe, thank you so much for coming on the show. You mentioned the URL for the podcast. What's the best way to get a hold of you if anybody wants to ask questions, offer a property, or potentially invest with you?
Yeah, the Real Estate Investing Club. Just go to that website. It'll have all the ways to get in contact with me. If you want to email me, it's just gabe@therealestateinvestingclub.com. And yeah, that's it.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Gabe.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks, Eugene, for having me on. Real Estate Development.